The Biological Jew by Eustace Mullins, Part 4. Another obsession of the parasite is that it must force its way into every aspect of the host's existence. It cannot endure the thought of a group of Gentiles discussing anything without the parasite or one of his Chavez Goy agents being present to make notes. Thus, the Jew campaigns to force his way into every Gentile organisation, whether it be social, religious, a private school, a club or a neighbourhood, anywhere that the Gentiles might be able to gather and talk over things which the Jew wishes to know. This obsession is due to the fact that the Jew can never know any real security in his parasitic existence. He lives daily with a terrible fear that the host will cast him off, and even when he has obtained control at every level of the Gentile's life, the Jew still feels insecure. If the Gentile manages to keep him out of anything, the Jew becomes wild with rage. This obsession with security was the real force behind the furor over the Dreyfus case in France during the last century. A Jew named Captain Dreyfus had managed to penetrate the formerly all-Gentile French high command. Soon afterwards, he was charged with selling French military secrets to the highest bidder. Although it was an open and shut case, as usual, the Jews launched a frantic international campaign to free him. It seemed odd that so much noise was raised over the fate of one French officer, but the theory of the biological parasite explains the mystery. The parasite had penetrated one of the last bastions of the Gentile host. Now he knew all the military secrets, and he was also in a position to inform his people if the army should become involved in a reaction against the presence of the parasites. But the parasite was arrested and charged as a traitor, which he was, because his primary loyalty was to the parasitic community. The tragedy is not that he is convicted, but that the Jews have lost their man in the nation's Security Council. At once, the entire parasite community charges to his defence, exhibiting terrible fear and anger. This rejection or exclusion is the fate which haunts the parasite, because for him it is a matter of life and death. If he is rejected by the host, he cannot lead his parasitic existence and he will die. Hence the great furor over the Dreyfus case. Democratic administrations in the United States have had a plethora of Dreyfus cases in recent years, in which a parasite who had burrowed into the nation's security councils was charged with disloyalty. One of them was Dr. Oppenheimer, a Jew whose social circle was composed of dedicated communist agents, most of whom were known as such, while he worked on our nation's most vital defence secrets. He was finally denied a security clearance due to public alarm over his background, and a terrible clamour arose from the international Jewish community, which went on for years. We still do not know how much damage he did to the nation. A more celebrated case was a Jew of Russian origins, Walt Rostow. He is only the person in charge of our national security. Yet a few years ago, loyal employees of the State Department refused Rostow a security clearance, not once, but three times, because of his notorious associations. Yet when John F. Kennedy became president, he placed Walt Rostow in charge of our national security. Drew Pearson recently revealed that it was this Jew who made the personal decision to employ American troops in large forces in Vietnam, one of the greatest victories for communism since 1917. While Americans were being slaughtered in Vietnam, Russia could sit back and watch us bleed to death without the communist world being weakened at all. In this Dreyfus case, the Jews have won every round, while the Gentile who exposed him, Otto Ortepka, is still being persecuted by our government. In France, a few clever Gentiles sensed which way the wind was blowing in the Dreyfus case, even if they had no understanding of the parasitic theory. An obscure hack writer named Emile Zola wrote some fiery articles, such as J'accuse, demanding that Dreyfus be freed, and the international Jewish propaganda machine immediately began to puff Zola as a great writer. He enjoyed great fame and fortune during the rest of his life, although his novels are now ignored. A pompous little country lawyer, Klemenko, also found his career in the Dreyfus case. He intervened on Dreyfus' behalf, and the Jews made him Premier of France. The way of the Shabbos Goy can be smoothed. The threat of rejection always stirs a torrent of fear and anger in the parasite. This writer encountered an example of this when he purchased a second-hand mattress in Jersey City. Late that night, he was awakened by an unwelcome presence. He switched on the light, and there on his stomach was a fat little bedbug, swollen with its feast, and reluctant to abandon its host, even in the light of exposure. When the light came on, the bedbug gave a furious shriek of anger and waddled out of sight. At this time, the writer did not immediately relate this episode to the theory of the biological parasite, but he later reflected that this anger of the bedbug, which was carrying on its usual activity, was understandable. We cannot expect the Jew to appreciate any effort of the Gentile host to dislodge him and remove him from the feast. This is why he works day and night to prevent such a thing from happening. This is why the Jew must control our communications. This is why he must control our education. This is why he must control our government, and most importantly, this is why he must control our religion. If he fails to do this in any area, he endangers his continued existence as a biological parasite. Even in the Soviet Union, with its idealistic slogan of "from each according to his means to each according to his needs," the parasite gains control over Gentile workers and sets him to producing goods, which he sells and then pockets the proceeds. Fat Jews and their blonde mistresses stroll from their luxurious villas on the Black Sea, while intense, dogmatic Gentile commissars, such as Mikhail Suslov, sit in the Kremlin, trying desperately to devise a system which the Jew cannot twist to his own advantage. They cannot succeed, because the parasite has always thought one step ahead of them. When the Jews seized the lands of peaceful Arab farmers by aggression in 1948, many Gentiles throughout the world supposed that a new era had begun. These Gentiles assured each other, now that they have their own country, the Jews will go there and stop exploiting us. Instead, the parasitic communities in all parts of the world intensified their exploitations of their Gentile hosts in order to meet the vast needs of the new state of Israel. Garment workers in the notorious New York sweatshops, most of them Negro and Puerto Rican women and children, had large portions of their earnings extorted from them by the cold-blooded Jew, David Dubinsky, the fascist dictator of the Garment Union. These funds were turned over to the State of Israel. This illustrates the facility of the Jew for being on all sides and for always being on the winning side. Haim Weizmann, the founder of the State of Israel, quotes an oft-repeated saying of his mother in his autobiography, Trial and Error. Quote, "Whatever happens, I shall be well off. If Shemuel, the revolutionary son, is right, we shall all be happy in Russia. And if Haim, the Zionist, is right, then I shall go to live in Palestine. Close quote. On April 17, 1950, the New York Times announced that the annual budget of the State of Israel had been released. It was composed of 70% of donations from abroad and 30% from the sale of Israeli bonds, which never have any redeemable value and which could only be described as contributions. No other nation on earth could envision such a budget, for even India, the perennial beggar among nations, with its swollen and mongrelized population, can raise only 1% of its budget from abroad, and that is entirely donated by the United States. Yet the State of Israel confidently envisions a national budget for years to come, consisting of charity and the peddling of dubious paper. This is the budget of a nation of parasites, still depending upon the Gentile hosts. The bizarre, unhealthy existence of the parasite, with his trend to degeneracy and his decaying nervous system, places him outside of every known system of morality and human decency. Now he has perfected a Jewish hellbomb, which threatens to destroy the host and himself as well. When Alexander Sachs of the international Jewish banking firm of Lehman Brothers, New York, and Albert Einstein suggested to President Roosevelt that he invest hundreds of millions of dollars in the production of a hell bomb, how could Roosevelt refuse? Now, they needed a Gentile front for their project. Major General Leslie Groves was asked to head the project, but when he found that most of the scientists were Jewish, he asked to be excused, saying that he believed that a Jewish director would be more efficient in this atmosphere. "Not at all," he was assured. "We need a Gentile as the ostensible head of the project. Don't worry, we will all handle all of the responsibility." We know that the Gentile can never expect any mercy from the Jew. The horrible practice of ritual murder is sufficient evidence of this. The ritual murder of Gentile children, by bleeding them to death and drinking their blood, is the highest symbolic revelation of the theory of the biological parasite.
You're tuned in to Radio Stormer. DailyStormer.com.
Primitive man sometimes drank the blood of fallen foes as a symbol of victory and to absorb some of the strength of the enemy. But another blood-drinking practice, that of ritual murder, is the only one which has survived into modern times. This religious ceremony of drinking the blood of an innocent Gentile child is basic to the Jew's entire concept of his existence as a parasite, living off of the blood of the host. That is why he refuses to abandon this custom, even though it has brought him close to extinction many times. When the Jew can no longer symbolize his role by kidnapping a perfectly formed Gentile child, spiriting him away to a synagogue and ritually puncturing his body in the places which they boasted they had wounded the body of Christ, and drinking the blood of the dying child, then, according to Jewish belief, he is doomed. His prophets have warned him that when this custom can no longer be observed, the Jewish parasite's hold onto the host will be loosened and he will be cast off. Even though this ceremony is so horrible that most Jews refuse to participate in it and all of them deny its practice, it still remains the final method by which the Jewish leaders signify and retain their control over this people. Should they abandon the practice of ritual murder, perhaps there would be a possibility that the Jew could be weaned away from his historical role as a biological parasite and become a constructive member of the Gentile community, turning his back upon a record of 5,000 years of bloodshed, treachery, and murder, which is his entire history. We say perhaps because we do not know. Viewing this prospect from the biological realities, it seems unlikely that the Jew could renounce his past and join Gentile society as a contributing member. Certainly, we find no evidence of it in the writings of the Jews themselves, even at the present time. From the most religious of them to the most worldly, their attitude towards the Gentile host is the same, a fierce, undying hatred. Consider what the high priestess of the modern Jewish intellectuals, Susan Sontag, has to say in the Jewish house organ, The Partisan Review, in 1967. Quote, "The white race is the cancer of history. It is the white race and it alone, its ideologies and inventions, which eradicates autonomous civilization wherever it spreads." Close quote. These 27 words capsule an enormous amount of information about the parasite-host relationship. First, it is an expression of the undying hatred which the parasite bears for its white race host. Second, it reveals that the Jew has never and will never consider himself as part of the white race, which it regards as a separate species. Third, this passage attributes savagery only to the white race, not to the bloodthirsty tribes of the Congo, not to the mass murders in China, nor to anyone except the highly developed North European civilization in Europe and America. And fourth, Susan Sontag reveals the entire situation in her phrase, autonomous civilization. What does she mean by autonomous civilization? She means the parasite community, which demands total freedom to attach itself to the host, to rule the host, and to prevent the host from casting it off. And she says here that the white race, because in the past it has reacted against the autonomous civilization of the Jewish parasite, is totally savage and evil.
Tune in to Radio Stormer on thedailystormer.com.
We have remarked upon the strange omission of words which one might expect in our libraries, works which treat of the phenomenon of parasitic communities in human civilizations, and we have suggested that these works have not been written because the parasite exercises control over the academic and scholarly life of the host. Is this a fantastic conclusion? Not at all. Since the host is physically stronger than the parasite, obviously the parasite cannot control him through physical strength. Then he must exercise mental control. How is this done? The Jewish parasite controls the Gentile host through an entire class of Gentiles which he has created and who serve him by maintaining control over the Gentile host. This class is known as the Shabbos Goy. We have pointed out that the Jewish parasite is a disease of the more advanced civilizations. One does not find the Jew sharing the hostile desert with the Australian Aborigine. Primitive man had no experience of parasites. There was little food and less shelter, but those who survived began to master their environment, to till the land, to domesticate animals, and there began to be surpluses of food. Now rats and cockroaches appeared, feasting on these surpluses. One of the heroes of the Jewish intellectual movement, Franz Kafka, wrote a work in which a man envisioned himself as a cockroach, writing out of some ancient racial memory, which has bemused thousands of university students who had it rammed down their throats by their professors with no explanation of its overtones. With these surpluses, there also appeared a new type of person, a variant of the species, one who existed by producing no goods or services, but who became adept at producing an illusion that he was giving goods and services. This was the Jew, who made his appearance upon the stage of history as a magician, a fortune teller, a petty thief, or, in the open country, a treacherous and cold-blooded bandit. He became a physician, a teacher, an acolyte in any kind of religious group. From earliest history, he practiced money-lending, and always at a usurious rate of interest. All of these Jewish vocations have one thing in common, the opportunity for fraud. The Jew always operated from a basis of fraud and slipped easily from one vocation into another. A Jew practiced medicine in one city, and leaving behind a trail of corpses, turns up in another town as a soothsayer. After some widows are bilked of their life savings, he again takes to the road, assisted, as always, by the international Jewish community. In another town, he becomes a student priest, and soon he offers daring new interpretations of the religious beliefs until his superiors find that he is stealthily transforming every tenet of their faith into some strange and barbaric dogma. He moves on and turns up in another city, as a highly trusted government official, respected by all, until one evening, the gates of the city are opened to an invader, and the Jew becomes the Grand Vizier of the conquerors. But is this parasitism, or is it merely crime? It is crime, yes, for each of these isolated events is a crime, but the whole is not merely crime, it is parasitism. Treason, fraud, perversion, all the hallmarks of Jewish life among the Gentiles in the diaspora. And it is parasitism. All of these things are not merely crimes in themselves. They are crimes which are committed as essential parts of the Jew's parasitical relationship with the Gentile host. We must remember that there is no Jewish crime per se, since the existence of the Jewish parasite upon the host is a crime against nature, because its existence imperils the health and the life of the host. Thus, everything the Jew does in connection with this parasitic existence is a criminal act and part of an overall criminal existence. A Gentile government, which had as its concern the health of the nation, would convict the Jewish parasite and cast him off. This has happened hundreds of times in recorded history. Therefore, the Jew knows that his first task upon arriving in a Gentile community is to subvert and take over its government, and to paralyze the people with subtle injections of poison so that they become helpless and unable to defend themselves. Thus, the Jew begins agitation to set up a progressive government, also known as a popular front, a democratic government, a people's government, a liberal government, and all of these are synonyms for the Jewish government, which will protect the presence of the parasite and guard it against the anger of the exploited Gentiles. When he has set up this government, usually by subversion, the Jew sets out to exterminate all of the former Gentile leaders whom he reviles as reactionaries, that is, those who might react against the presence of the parasite. First, they are prevented from engaging in any gainful employment. Then, they and all members of their families have their landholdings, bank accounts, and other assets confiscated. Finally, after extensive agitation against them, the Jew arouses the populace against them, and they are hunted down and killed because they might be able to set up a reactionary government if they are allowed to survive. Thus, the Jew has introduced the bloodthirsty custom of genocide, or extermination of groups, into world affairs. Now, does not this sound familiar? The confiscation of assets, the mass murders. Oh yes, Russia, 1917, the victory of the Bolsheviks, the carrying out of Marx's program of communism, when a government which believed in the principle of solidarity was installed to enslave the Gentile Russian people. The Tsar and his wife and children were murdered in cold blood because the biological Jew is not concerned with chivalry in his struggle to maintain control over the Gentile host. We have only to read the sadistic book of Esther in the Bible to see the Jewish custom of mass murder exposed in detail. Is the helplessness of the Gentile host before the onslaught of the parasite an essential weakness? We have only to think of the strong, healthy man subdued by flu virus to get the answer. Health, in all matters, is the principal defense against the attack of the parasitic virus. For centuries, the larger and stronger Gentile host has gone down in defeat before the smaller and weaker but more deadly parasitic virus. The survival of the Gentile host is a matter of understanding biological laws. The Gentile community has set up elaborate codes by which it lives, codes of honor, codes of laws, and the trust which the observance of these codes breeds in the members of the community. They respect the law. They respect each other's families. They respect each other's property, and they defend the nation when it is attacked. It is the code of honour which gives the Jewish parasite his first opening in the armour of the Gentile host, since this code is binding upon the Gentile host and its members achieve status in the community only if they observe it. But the parasite is bound only by his determination to achieve parasitic status upon the host. The Gentile's code is itself a biological phenomenon, since it grows out of his attitude towards all life, and it is a manifestation of his innate courage, his honour, and his industry, the virtues upon which he builds his nation. The code of the Jew is quite different. It is a code which abnegates all other codes. He agrees to pay one price and later settles only half of it. He appears in court with forged deeds and wills, paid perjured witnesses and kept judges, thus taking over Gentile properties. He takes advantage of the Gentile wives while their husbands are at work, thus shaming them. And in time of war, the Jew avoids army service and disrupts civilian life at home. At the times of gravest peril, he makes deals with the enemy and betrays the nation. Since the parasite depends upon the host for its food, we would suppose that it would do everything within its power to aid the Gentile community to become richer and more powerful, but overriding every other consideration is the parasite's determination to keep its position upon the host. For 5,000 years, history has recorded the efforts of Gentile hosts to dislodge their Jewish parasites. Empires rise and fall. Continents are discovered, wildernesses are explored and settled, and man makes progress through new inventions. Yet through it all, one factor remains constant. The Gentile host, fearful of the damage which it is suffering from the presence of the Jewish parasite, tries to dislodge it. The parasite has prepared for such efforts, which it always foresees, by attaching itself so securely to the host that the host only damages itself in its wild struggles. In some cases, the Gentile host destroys itself in these efforts. The Jewish parasite prefers seeing the Gentile host destroyed instead of leaving peaceably from a still living host. If the host dies, the parasite looks for another host. It has no feelings of any kind for the host which has provided it with food. This callous attitude is typical of the philosophy of the Jew, and it is exemplified by the current phrase so popular in Jewish Hollywood: who needs it? Like other Jewish sayings, this phrase has become part of contemporary American life, yet Gentiles do not know what it means. It means that the Jew does not need the Gentile host, because he can always find another one.